Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. On this Martin Luther King Day, we're going to begin our show by turning the clock back to 1965, a year in which King was in Philadelphia to press for the desegregation of Girard College.
Dr. King is now arriving here in West Philadelphia, in a predominantly Negro area, for his first public rally of the day. This after spending the morning conferring with civil rights leaders here.
I must face the fact that it is a sad experience at this stage of the 20th century to have to stand in the city that has been known as the cradle of liberty, that has in its midst and in its presence a kind of Berlin Wall to keep the colored children of God out. For this wall, or this school, is symbolic of a tragic evil in our nation. It is symbolic of a cancer in the body politic, which must be removed before our democratic health can be realized.
King spoke before a massive rally at Girard College, a full scholarship boarding school for economically disadvantaged children. At the time, it was open only to white boys who were orphaned, as per the instruction of its founder, Stephen Girard. Philadelphia civil rights leader Cecil B. Moore was at the forefront of the campaign to desegregate the school, and as rallies began to pick up steam, they drew the attention of King, who threw his support behind the effort. Martin Luther King's appearance at the demonstration in August of 1965 was recorded by KYW-TV. We are now joined by Karen Asper Jordan. She is president of the Cecil B. Moore Philadelphia Freedom Fighters, and she was at the rally. Good to have you with us, Karen.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So let's start by talking about the day of the demonstration. 56 years ago, you were, about 16 years old.
Correct.
Bring us there, if you will. Describe what you saw at this massive act of peaceful protest and the emotion around it.
Well, we lived around the corner from Girard College. We were blocks away from the main entrance. And when we had woken up that morning, we saw all the police and the barricades. They were shoulder to shoulder. And on our way around, we were harassed by the police officers that were there. Not all of them, but some of them. So we told Cecil B. Moore once we got to the front of Girard College. That was the first time I had met him. I knew of him with the different demonstrations that the NAACP had had. The guys that I was with talked me into going over to tell him, and I did. And he said, I told him, I said, Mr. Moore, I said, those cops are messing with us. He said, they're not going to be messing with my damn people. Hmm. And he said he's going to take care of it, and he walked off. I had never heard someone of that magnitude, of that position, speak so forcefully, and the commanding presence that he had, I knew he was going to get something done. And from then on, we started to come to Girard College to demonstrate. We were impressionable young teenagers working our way into adulthood. We still went to the parties. We had the dances. We worried about our hair, boyfriends, and things like that. We were just normal kids. Once we started at Girard College, it put something in us. Something blossomed in us from being around such wonderful people. And our mentors were the people from the NAACP.
So the demonstration on the day in August of 1965 in which Dr. Martin Luther King spoke, what was that like? And you actually got to meet Dr. King at one point, didn't you?
Yes, I did. It was exciting because there were a lot of people there. And I just felt like, as a young person, we were there watching history being made, you know, to have such a great man come to Philadelphia, you know, to lend his support. And he was among hundreds of people that came to support our fight at Girard College. How I met Dr. King was on the platform where he was speaking, because a lot of the platforms were just trucks. Mm-hmm. And I got to meet him. I stuttered. Oh. He kind of hugged me, and he and his wife smiled at me because I was stuttering. And that's when I met him. And that day, while we were demonstrating, going back to Girard College, trying to get people to come to Girard College, carrying those flags, we had one right side up and we had one upside down as a sign of distress, you know, about the plight of the African-American in this country. We were pulled over by the Philadelphia Police Department, and they lied and said that we spit on the flag and we stomped the flag.
You were arrested that day, weren't you?
Yes, we were. 16 years old. To have somebody lie on you, and they were police officers, and the fact that the people in the neighborhood knew that they were lying, and that we got probation for that, it was disheartening.
In a conversation with our producer, Paige Murray Bessler, Karen, you said, we were very brave at the time. And again, you were about 16 years old. What were your fears?
We were brave because some of the police officers were very threatening to the people. Some of the kids that were there were beaten. You know, the adults were beaten. And it didn't matter whether you were a child, whether you were a woman, whether you were a man, it didn't matter. If the police charged you, they beat whatever was in their path. And that happened on a few occasions at Girard College.
So after the demonstration at Girard, in 1965, it took almost 3 years for a Supreme Court decision mandating desegregation at the school. What did waiting for that decision feel like? Were you discouraged or hopeful?
No, because we believed and we knew we were going to be successful. And that was from the people that we associated ourselves with. Cecil B. Moore, one of the greatest civil rights activists here in Philadelphia and in the country. We believed in what he said. And when Cecil did things, you didn't have to wait 20 years for it to happen. If there were segregation, racism practices, discrimination, and we went to those businesses, it wasn't long before we saw the results. We believed and we knew that things were going to change.
When the decision about Girard, regarding Girard, was handed down by the court, what went through your mind?
We celebrated. We celebrated because that was a victory. It was a special, special occasion. We did it. And to think that so many people thought that it would never happen. You know, today there seems to be more Philadelphia Freedom Fighters was founded by Mel Dorn Chamberlain. His saying was, we loved you before we knew you. And it all brings us to mind all of the people that have come before us, that have sacrificed their livelihood for us and didn't know us. And we tried to do the same thing for our children. So we were children ourselves.
I'd like to play one more clip from the rally at Girard College in 1965. Here's Martin Luther King Jr.
Don't wait until next year. We've got to realize that the moment is before us now. I know there are people who tell us to cool off. The only problem there is that we've cooled off too many years now, and there's a danger that we will end up in a deep freeze. That we can't cool off because of our self-respect, because we love America too much. They tell us to adopt a policy of gradualism, and we've often adopted that policy only to discover that gradualism is little more than a do-nothingism and an escapism which ends up in standstillism. We must say to the nation at this moment, now is the time. To make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time. To transform the dark yesterdays of man's inhumanity to man into the bright tomorrows of justice and freedom. Now is the time. To get rid of segregation and discrimination. Now is the time. To straighten up Girard College. Now is the time. To give freedom. Now is the time to grant freedom to the Negro all over the United States of America. Now is the time to make America a greater nation. And so I say to you, don't wait until next week to get in this struggle in Philadelphia.
Don't wait until tomorrow morning to get in this struggle in Philadelphia. Don't wait until an hour from now to get in this struggle to make this city and our nation a greater city and a greater nation. Get in this struggle at this moment.
So Karen asked for Jordan, how would you describe today's social justice challenges? And do King's words resonate today?
They will always resonate. And Dr. King and the voices of all the other people that would like, that want human rights and want equality will always resonate. It's a challenge in today's time when you see what's going on in Congress, when you see the backsliding, when you see the people that want to talk about how great Dr. King is, and they go along with this inhumane, I say, government officials, with these evangelicals that talk about Dr. King and the human condition, and they're putting their foot on people's backs. They're putting people in jeopardy, and it's a disgrace, and it's a shame, and not one of them should utter Dr. King's name in their mouths, because they're against everything, or many of the things, or the main things that he fought for.
How then should change be affected? What is a first step, in your opinion, Karen?
The first step is to, and as far as voting, we have to get out and we have to get the vote out and we have to get these people out of office. And we have to vote and we have to call each other. We have to call other people and we have to talk to other people. And we have to have hope that things are going to change. Things do get worse sometimes, but we always come out ahead, and we have to keep that. We have to keep hope.
What are you hearing from young people, Karen Asper Jordan?
What I hear from young people is that on one hand, you have the young people that, those activists that are out there, they're staying the course. You have others that say, what difference does it make? A lot of them don't sound any different than the adults out here. But I have my put my faith in the young people of today. They're committed. They love themselves. They love humanity. And I put my faith in them because I know that they're going to make a difference. They know there's some hard times coming out there, but they're going to make a difference, just like we made a difference back in those days. They're going to make a difference, and I believe in them.
Karen Asper Jordan, thank you so much for joining us on this Martin Luther King Day. We appreciate it.
You're more than welcome.
Take care. Karen Asper Jordan is president of the Cecil B. Moore Philadelphia Freedom Fighters. Up next on the Regional Roundup, we rebroadcast our interview with Ethan Demme, founder of the Pennsylvania chapter of the Serve America movement, a third political party whose goal is to move away from polarized politics. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The United States has had a two-party political system in place pretty much since its founding. And even as third parties have periodically gained traction among the electorate, none has been able to breach the dominance of the current majority Republican or Democrat parties. However, some say the insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th may prove a watershed moment, ripe for the success of a third party whose goal is to bring Americans of different views together, even as it works for transparency in the election process. Ethan Demme was a longtime member of the GOP and a former local party chair for the Republican Party in Lancaster County. He recently left the party and has opened a new chapter of the Serve American Movement in Serve America movement in Pennsylvania. SAM is a relatively new political party, and Ethan Demme joins us now to discuss SAM and the principles behind it. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
First, Ethan, tell us a bit about yourself and why you decided to step away from the GOP.
I live in Lancaster County, and I've been involved in party politics for about 20 years. I worked my first campaign when I was 14 years old in 1996. So I've sort of been doing the politics thing for a while. I'm currently an elected township supervisor in East Lampeter Township. And I used to be the Republican Party chair in Lancaster County back in 2010, 2011.
So what was the catalyst that helped you to determine that the GOP was something you needed to walk away from?
Well, even when I was in the GOP, I was always a little bit of a reform-minded person. So I've always advocated for things like term limits, for trying to get more transparency into politics. I've been in favor of gerrymandering reform. So I've always had some tension with some of the elements of the Republican Party. In 2016, I ran for the state Senate. Donald Trump was also running, and I was one of those hashtag never Trumpers. So at that point, I was much more disenchanted when my party chose Donald Trump as its leader. But it really came to a head with the election denials after the election last November. The big lie kept perpetrating, and my local elected officials just maintained silence or went along with it. And no one was standing up and saying, no, we had a fair election. President Biden is the elected president of the United States. I can't even get my state rep or state senator to say that in public now. And then on January 6th, watching the images come out of the riot at the Capitol building, that was the last straw. And then followed up with my congressman, along with the majority, vast majority of Republican congressmen voting to decertify the elections. That was the last straw to me. It was no longer a party of ideas. It was a party of personality. And that's when I left on January 7th.
Well, on that day, you and two fellow local Republicans wrote to the chair of the Lancaster Republican Party to say enough is enough. The denial of the 2020 election results by members of the party was outrageous, and that denying the facts fomented the seeds of sedition and led to the violence at the Capitol. So when you published this, Ethan, what sort of reaction did you receive from your fellow party members who were close at hand?
There was most folks were silent. I got a couple, you know, angry emails, but the vast majority of feedback I got was people encouraging me, thanking me for, and my fellow township supervisors for also standing up for something. A lot of private messages I got said, we wish that our congressman, our state representative, or our senator would say these things, but everyone else is silent. So thank you for standing up. So across from independents to Democrats to lots of Republicans who said thank you for standing up. So there are a lot of sort of, I call it the non-vocal folks who don't go to protests, who want good government, but they were very encouraging. So I was actually surprised at the feedback that we got. There was some nasty grams that you get, but that comes with the territory.
Well, so the Serve America movement, this party has been around, I think, since about 2017. Why did you gravitate toward SAM, and is there a platform? What are the goals of this party?
Yeah, so right after January 7th, a small group of us started talking about what could we do to make things better in Pennsylvania. We saw the Republican Party as unreformable from within, and we weren't fans of the polarization that we saw also happening in the Democratic Party. The big problem we see is polarization happening. There's good folks in both parties and outside of the party structure, but it's the loudest, you know, 20% of both parties that are dictating where those candidates go in the primaries. So we looked for something that was a little more ideological, flexible, didn't have any rigid boxes, and also stood for reforms like term limits, like redistricting reform, like open primaries. How do we get more people to participate in the process? So as we were talking through and holding some informal meetings, we came across the Serve America movement, currently led by David Jolly, former congressman from Florida. Had several conversations with him, and then we said, hey, we're all sort of pushing in the same direction. Let's just join forces. So myself and a few others launched the Serve America movement in Pennsylvania, and now we're jumping off on our new endeavor and trying to recruit some candidates for 2022.
Well, on the website, the Serve America Movement website, it says, SAM is a new party for a new majority. We are current and former Democrats, Republicans, and independents who have come together with a common goal to fix our broken politics in America. So can you be, I just want to clarify, can you be a Democrat or Republican and also belong to the Serve America Movement party?
Sure. And this has been something that's worked well in states like New York and Connecticut, where Sam has been established for a couple years, is they've run unity tickets where a Democrat and Republican run on the same ticket but endorsed by the Sam party. We're planning on endorsing candidates in both major parties who agree with us on our reform platform. Oftentimes people talk about a big tent party, and what they really mean is the Republicans used to be more big tent, the Democrats used to be more big tent, but that meant they were sort of right-leaning or left-leaning but allowed some moderates. A true big tent is folks who have belief systems that dot across the entire political spectrum, and that's what we're trying to do. We think that people should actually argue and disagree and take their beliefs into the public square and have rigorous debate, but we should do it without being disagreeable. And at the end, we need to come to a consensus and actually govern. And that's what we see missing in Harrisburg.
Well, Ethan, Demi, obviously we're polarized, and in part because there's a tendency to demonize the other side. How do we achieve respectful dialogue with people we might not see eye to eye with on hot button issues like guns or abortion? You know, those issues that tend to get the hackles up fairly quickly. And how might Sam help to facilitate respectful dialogue?
I think it comes by modeling it, is one of the big things. I mean, I've got four little kids, and we try to teach them that they should express their feelings and tell people when what they're doing they don't like, and also explain what they want. And we have that dialogue, but at the end of the day, you do need to make a decision and move on. So the same way we should be modeling it to our kids is how we should be modeling it in government. Or in running for office. So hosting forums, we hosted an online forum prior to the last primary. Independents were eligible to vote for the ballot petitions. So we held a discussion. We didn't have a position on how you should vote, but we think people should be informed on that. So we held a discussion on that. It's really about how do we solve problems as elected officials. We need to listen. We need to define the problem. We need to actually engage with all the stakeholders. Invite people to public meetings. Oftentimes, whether it's local government, school boards, there's a large barrier of entry to engaging in local politics or even in state politics. And so how can we lower that barrier to get more of the general populace engaged in that political process?
You write that we are living the inverse of the old Tip O'Neill adage that all politics is local, that big tent politics is an issue. So tell us about why. So is local politics essentially being ignored in today's political process in large?
Yes. I mean, I've seen this in local races, even for township races where Republican mailers are being sent out saying we're not going to defund the police when no one on the other side of the aisle is running with that as part of their platform. You've got pictures, black and white pictures of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Nancy Pelosi in local township mailers. And your position on the previous president is the number one factor that is going to turn out candidates in a Republican primary. So that's sort of the polarization we see. When at the end of the day, whether it's local townships dealing with trash pickup issues like I deal with in East Lampeter Township, or it's a state representative in Adams County and a state representative in Dauphin County or Montgomery County, the issues are very different based off of those regions. But too often, what the vocal minority wants to hear is what's the national hot-button culture war topic of the day.
Yeah. Let's talk about the character and the strength of elected officials. You wrote an op-ed earlier this month about what you see as a lack of leadership in this country. Some powerful words. The founders of this country anticipated the problem of ambition in elected officials and therefore created a brilliant system of checks and balances to mitigate it. But they did not anticipate widespread cowardice in public officials. The two major parties have rotted from within because far too few party leaders and politicians over the past 50 years care more about their country than their own careers and power. Tell us a little bit more about why you wrote this.
The idea of political service should be about service, but oftentimes it's become a career. We have public pensions for our school teachers and for our police officers because we want someone to stay in that job for a long period of time. It's a difficult job, and keeping someone in that job is beneficial. Keeping someone in Harrisburg is not beneficial to anyone. but people more concerned about keeping their pension and their reelection than they are about standing up and saying what is actually true or not true. I've talked to many, many Republicans and Democrats, elected officials off the record. Every single one of them knows without a shadow of a doubt that the election was fair last year, but none of them are willing to say it out loud. And that's the failure of leadership that I see, where people are afraid to say what they know is true because there's a vocal minority that might protest.
Yeah, and maybe even lash out online.
Or show up to their houses. I mean, we've reached a tipping point in America where violence, actual physical violence, is a political strategy. Whether it's shutting down a street, whether it's attacking a capital, whether it's occupying a capital, we see this. It's not just both sidesism. We see violence as a political strategy, and we've seen it for the last 5-plus years. January 6th was the biggest, worst one, but that is now an actual strategy employed by political actors.
And you take aim at, quote, culture warriors on primetime cable news shows, end quote. How does consumption of this stuff affect viewers and eventually the political parties to which they belong?
Yeah, with cable news, we now have people listening to the news that they want to hear. We've lost sort of the public square where everyone has the opportunity to engage, and we have the internet, which allows everyone to engage, but we self-select into our certain microcosms. So in my opinion, the best thing we could do is walk next door to our neighbors and ask them, talk to them. When you talk to people face-to-face, you remove a lot of that angst, where when we're behind the keyboard or yelling at the TV, we can get very fired up and angry. But then you walk next door and you meet a Republican, a Democrat, or an independent, and you talk about how can we make our community better. That's what we need to get back to, is just good old grassroots politics where we actually look each other in the eye and talk to each other.
Should the Serve America movement try to find a home on television, on radio, in social media, in order to provide an antidote to the culture warriors?
Well, that's what we're doing. We have, if you go to joinsam.org, or we also have the SAM Studio, we have a podcast where we're trying to get some different perspectives on there. We're active on social media, but we're also moving forward with getting candidates out there, because there's a lot of great groups who are trying to advocate for good things like No Labels or Fair Districts PA or openprimaries.org. There's some really good folks doing great advocacy work. But I think the biggest thing is that SAM can bring to the table is running actual candidates in some of these state house, Senate races, congressional races, and then forcing the dialogue to be broader, to be more inclusive, to actually listen to the needs of that individual community. So we're agnostic as to the individual ideology of each candidate. We want them to have a process that says we want to engage, we want to listen, we want to reform government so that more people can participate in the electoral process.
So, Ethan Demme, traditionally it has been challenging for a third-party candidate to get on the ballot in Pennsylvania. How do you see that going with SAM candidates?
Well, the thing is, in the last couple of years, there's been some changes in Pennsylvania. It is very difficult for third parties to get any traction. But what you're seeing in Pennsylvania, the elimination of straight party balloting, so you have to choose candidates when you go to the polls. You can't choose a party. That's a big shift. And then currently, the ballot access requirements are now, for the first time in Pennsylvania, an equal playing field. So any candidate can run. The signature requirements are the same for third-party candidates as they are for major party candidates. Those two factors, I think, will play well for us in 2022.
You'd taken a swing at both major political parties in Pennsylvania for having worked to keep independents off the ballot. With these changes, do you see that sentiment changing among the major parties in the state?
There's some glimmers of light. I mean, there's definitely good lawmakers on both sides of the aisle who have proposed legislation to open up our primaries. That would be a big one. Right now, you're ineligible to vote if you're not registered with a major party, but your tax dollars still pay for that election. If the parties want to have a closed primary, then they should pay for it. But if the taxpayers have to pay for it, then everyone should be eligible to vote in the primaries. So open primaries is one, but that's a bipartisan bill in the Senate right now that could open up Pennsylvania primaries.
Political success, of course, can be heavily dependent on funding. Who is supporting the Serve America Movement Party at this time?
Well, currently we're getting some seed funding. Think of us like a startup. So the national organization is helping us with building out our party infrastructure and getting us sort of brand identification in Pennsylvania, trying to get the word out. But then once we start to get established, we'll be doing local fundraising here in Pennsylvania, and our candidates will be doing their own fundraising as well. So we're starting with some seed funds from the national group, which is very helpful, but then we'll be shifting over to local funding after that.
Yeah. You've got a big challenge ahead of you, Ethan Demme. I mean, the culture, in changing the culture, Senate President Pro Tem Jay Quirman is still agitating for a partisan review of the 2020 election results and figuratively threw fellow State Senator Doug Mastriano under the bus recently for not making that happen. Are you optimistic about the success of the Serve America movement?
I'm optimistic. There's over 60% of Americans and lots of folks in Pennsylvania who really want a third party to be successful. I also am pragmatic enough to recognize that it's an uphill battle. So we're not looking at a 1 year quick movement. We're here to build a political movement that runs for multiple years. You can have a couple independent candidates. Our state party chair in Texas, Bill King, I mentioned this in the podcast the other day. He said, when you have one candidate run, you can maybe make a dent in that election. But you do need a party structure to sort of keep that momentum going from year to year. So our goal is to recruit candidates and run, but then keep that momentum building from 2022 to 2023 and beyond. So we're here for the long haul, and we're trying to make a difference to make Pennsylvania better.
That was our interview with Ethan Demme, Pennsylvania chair of the Serve America movement. Up next, we'll speak with psychiatrist Tammy Benton about the growing mental health crisis affecting young children today. Stay tuned. You are listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The mental health crisis affecting our nation's children and teens has been made worse by the pandemic. It is increasingly tough for families to find treatment. There's a shortage of care. Too few psychologists, social workers, nurse practitioners, and other professionals are working in this field. And there are waiting lists at numerous residential treatment facilities. Many children suffering severe behavioral crises end up at medical facilities like Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, which are set up for short-term acute treatment, not extended residential therapy. Such immediate care can offer incomplete relief, and often families find themselves caught in a nightmare, stymied by the long wait for residential treatment and unable to care for their children at home. Dr. Tammy Benton is psychiatrist-in-chief and chair of the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and she joins us now on the Regional Roundup. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad I could join you this morning.
You testified before Congress earlier this year and said the pandemic has made the situation worse. What are children experiencing that is driving this mental health crisis?
Yeah, they're experiencing all the complex circumstances that we as adults experience with much less control. And, you know, the uncertainty about the future and the lack of control has really been a challenge for all of us. So prior to the pandemic, we were struggling with increased rates of anxiety and depression and more young people and their families seeking services that we were not able to meet their needs. Prior to the pandemic, the average wait for an appointment, regardless of your insurance, was about 50 days. Mm. And we were already struggling to see children prior to the pandemic. Once the pandemic began, children lost their structure. They lost their social activities. Families were stressed. For those, many lost their jobs. For those who didn't lose their jobs, they were facing the challenges of maintaining their jobs and trying to homeschool their children. And then school was really challenged because we pivoted very, very quickly to online school. So many schools were unprepared. And we were seeing preschoolers who were doing online learning when those are not the appropriate platforms for young people. So it was just an incredibly hectic, stressful time for children and their families.
You told of being called to the emergency department at CHOP to see a very young child who was threatening suicide, a five-year-old?
Yes, and, you know, I have to say, as surprising as it was to me, it wasn't surprising because it never happens. It was surprising because it's been happening with more frequency. Mm-hmm. So prior to the pandemic, we did at times see young children, children who were preschool age, coming in for emergency mental health services, some of them presenting with what appear to be symptoms of depression, occasionally suicidal speech. But we saw more of that during the pandemic. So the groups of young people that we frequently see presenting to the emergency department are adolescents, usually middle to older adolescents. During the pandemic, what we started to see was more young children presenting in distress, most of which had to do with changes that had happened in their homes. So their parents had lost work. Parents were stressed. Parents became depressed and struggled with their own mental health conditions. This was especially true if they were experiencing those conditions prior to the pandemic. But even for families who were doing well, they started to deal with a tremendous amount of stress and not able to attend to the needs of their children. Yeah. And then for young children, many times when parents change or they're not as available, they interpret that as being their responsibility. Somehow they have something to do with it. And even though younger children may not wish to be ultimately dead forever, they do know how to do things that can cause harm. So in the case of this particular five-year-old, yeah, she said what we typically hear, which is they can run into traffic, they can hang themselves.
Oh, my goodness.
They can find ways to do things that cause permanent harm, even though permanent harm may not be their intent. And that's what prompted the call. So typically, for a child that age, our staff would not have considered something like a hospitalization for the youngster, but her threat was a real threat.
But Dr. Benton, your challenge was you found yourself unable to provide the appropriate avenue of care for this child. That must have been, as a provider and as the chief psychiatrist at CHOP, that must have been a really tough moment for you.
It was an extremely tough moment for me, and it occurred at the same time that we were all as mental health providers experiencing a tremendous amount of stress, you know, in coping with what was happening with all the young people. So it was, you know, it's part of the struggle of how do you try to keep moving when there's stressful circumstances around you. And so we hospitalized her at CHOP in a medical bed until we were able to decrease some of the stress that was happening in the family and eventually able to make some connections to provide care. But that actually took a significant amount of time.
One of the issues is apparently there is a shortage of professional caregivers and, again, residential treatment beds. Let's get into that a little bit. Why is this happening?
This isn't new. We struggled with having adequate placements for children for some time. We really saw that hit us the hardest back around 2015 and 2016 in Philadelphia when the crisis response center closed. But also around that time, some of the residential treatment programs closed as well. We struggled with the shortage for many years. Many young people were previously sent out of state, but there has been a national movement to decrease the number of kids who are living in what's called congregate care, which they're living in community residential facilities, and an effort to try to reunite children with families, which is a good effort. But there are populations of young people who need longer-term care. The hospital systems that we currently use for psychiatric emergencies, acute inpatient psychiatric facilities, are not prepared to treat children who have much longer-term needs. I think what we're seeing is the long-term impact of not investing enough in the infrastructure for mental health, not investing enough in supporting more providers, you know, not investing enough in educating enough mental health professionals, and not enough reimbursement to motivate organizations to expand those facilities.
So you brought up a number of points there. I'm sorry to interrupt. Not providing enough support for providers. A lot of these folks say they have debt from going through school, through medical schools, so, you know, doctoral programs, et cetera. Address that for us, if you will. Is that a disinclination for them to get into these fields?
Yes. And following that, even if you make the investment and you get into the field, the reimbursement is so poor that you can't meet your responsibilities. And the end result of that, and this has been occurring for some time, is that many people choose to go into private practice where the reimbursement is better. So currently, in our current mental health structures, to decrease costs, there's been certain arrangements made with some of the payers and the managed care companies where those services are actually separate services from your medical services. So, for example, if you come to CHOP, it's possible that your surgical services are covered by your medical payer, but then there's another whole company that's managing your mental health benefits. And those rates have traditionally been much lower for individual providers. And as a result, they can't necessarily afford to do that. And even if they were interested in working in underserved areas, they do have to make more money to pay back their student loans. This is true across mental health specialists. It's true for child psychiatrists, you know, and which is a very small group of providers. For child psychiatrists there in the state of Pennsylvania, there are 25 child psychiatrists per 100,000 young people. But there's also shortages of psychologists, social workers, nurse practitioners, and other community workers who can provide mental health services. And so addressing some of the infrastructure deficits that we experience could go a long way.
So as far as elected officials are concerned, where do they stand on this, in particular in increasing rates and reimbursement for mental health?
So I am optimistic. For the first time in my career, I've seen significant bipartisan support at the state and the federal level for addressing the mental health crisis. I think in states across the United States, parents and others and teachers and people who care for kids are bringing these issues forward. And currently there are several bills that have been proposed to address some of the mental health shortages. But I definitely think this has become a focus of national attention with a high level of investment in addressing it.
We are speaking with Tammy Benton, psychiatrist in chief and executive director and chair of the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Earlier, Tammy, you were talking about the fact that even before the pandemic, there was a wait for an appointment even for 50 days. What does a family go through in trying to care for this child if they have to wait 50 days to get appropriate treatment?
It's incredibly stressful for families. And I have to say, honestly, it's the thing that keeps me up at night. The concern for the long waits that are made available to families. We try to address the waits for young people in crisis, even in urgent need. They come to the emergency department because in the emergency department, you can receive some acute care. But what's unfortunately happened for families is as the stress levels continue, they can't wait 50 days for an appointment, nor should they have to wait 50 days for an appointment. So families come to the emergency department to seek care. Unfortunately, you know, it creates another challenge, which is for the kids who actually are in acute crisis, you know, it slows down your care delivery. And for the kids in acute crisis, they end up in the hospital. The root problem, the root cause is that when parents need assistance, if they would get the services that they need at the time they requested them, we wouldn't see the need for acute services. You know, primary outpatient care is preventive, and we're looking for other ways to expand that access for parents. So, for example, it takes much less time to get in to see your primary care pediatrician, and we're partnering with the primary care clinicians to be able to provide some of the services that families can receive in their own communities.
Comment from Kate, universal income would help alleviate these mental health struggles because it gives people who are desperate in their lives help with the financial aspects like finding child care or being able to afford care. Is this part of the conversation, Dr. Tammy Benton, a universal income when you go before Congress, when you speak with state legislators?
So we have actually spoken with asking for any resources that will allow families to have care where they need it, right? So families deserve to have care in their own communities where they live. And so support for school mental health, support for universal child care, universal early education, all the services at points of entry that would allow families access, we're supporting all of those things. So, for example, most children actually receive their mental health services in their schools. And those are places that parents don't have to go to specialized providers, don't have to navigate a whole new system, but all things that support the ability of families to access services they need at any point of entry is what we're supporting with our legislators.
Are those services available in school districts, like the School District of Philadelphia, for instance, which serve many low-income communities? Are they readily available in schools there?
So in many schools they are, and the City of Philadelphia worked with the schools to expand mental health services in the schools, but unfortunately with the pandemic, one of the things we experienced is schools closed, and all those young people lost their services. Mm. And so those services are available. We're looking to expand them. They clearly need more, and they face the same challenges that we face in specialty or hospital care settings of actually not having enough providers to provide the services that you need. They work it out and they do the best that they can for financial reasons. If a school or a community mental health center needs more specialists, they can't necessarily afford that. If they need five child psychiatrists, maybe they can afford one.
Wow.
But they do, the services are available in the schools, but the schools will be the first to tell you that they actually need more.
So from published reports, a third of all children will experience a mental health condition during their lifetimes. Fewer than 20% will receive specialized care. What becomes of those who don't receive the care they need?
What we do know is that the long-term outcomes for young people with untreated mental health conditions are poor. But that being said, the 20% see subspecialists. You know, the reality is that more young people could be served in other settings than subspecialty settings. So subspecialty care settings really should ideally serve young people who are struggling with more significant mental health conditions. Some of the mental health conditions in their early phases, such as anxiety and depression, could actually be treated in the school setting or in the primary care setting or other community settings. If we could catch kids earlier, they wouldn't need all of the subspecialty services. But for that 20% of, you know, the 20% who are treated, those tend to be the people who are in the greatest distress.
Yeah.
And individuals who have moderate to severe mental health conditions who are not treated tend to have worse outcomes. So, for example, depression can be treated, but if your depression is never treated, it increases your risk for suicide. It increases your risk for school failure. It increases your risk for poor educational and professional opportunities. All of those, you know, impair young people's ability to be productive.
So what are the signs that a child might be heading toward a mental health crisis? What should parents or caregivers look out for?
Mental health conditions occur on a continuum. So there are young people who have anxiety, and that anxiety drives them to perform better. Those things become pathological or concerning when you start to see a decline in functioning. And so if you had a youngster who was previously doing okay and you notice that they're not spending time with their friends, they're not getting along with their family, they're not doing well in school, and some parents would say, my teens frequently don't get along with their parents. It's not what's normal, it's what changes.
Mm.
And with those changes, that's when one should be concerned and start to talk to their youngster about what's going on with them.
And also then seek the first step, which would be to go to perhaps a mental health counselor at the school or the pediatrician, the child's pediatrician.
That should be the first line. That should be the first line of action. And it's because many times your pediatrician or your school health counselor or others, because, you know, there's counselors at the community recreation centers or your church. Sometimes your pediatrician and your school counselor can help you with your problem. If they can't, they'll typically know who they can refer you to.
That was our interview with Dr. Tammy Benton. She's psychiatrist-in-chief at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Our engineer today is Diana Martinez, our producer, Paige Mary Bessler. And on this Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, we close the regional roundup with We Shall Overcome, a key anthem of the civil rights movement. This is a clip from the 1965 demonstration against the segregation of Girard College, at which Dr. King spoke. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Be well.